any event is an event. It's us, people, that attach emotions to it, whether that's like a positive or negative. It's just an event. And obviously this was a life-changing event. And once I had gone through essentially what is a grieving process, because something did die, my genetics, my ability to be able to pass on my DNA, my genetics died. So what I didn't know at the time was I was grieving. I went through the stages of kind of anger, denial, blame. I remember phoning my mum, because the only people that knew throughout from the outset was my mum and my wife's mum. So we could kind of just talk to someone.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dad show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're an existing listener, then welcome back and thanks for your ongoing support. And if you're a new listener, thanks for discovering this podcast, and hopefully the things we speak about on here will resonate with you. I took a break in the schedule. Now, for 18 months, I've been doing this podcast without any breaks at all in the schedule, and so I needed some much-needed downtime with my family. So I took that, I'm back, and it's an opportunity to line up some new and amazing guests in the next little while. So make sure that you stay tuned in and stay listening, because we have a number of guests covering some very interesting subjects coming up. I appreciate you guys tuning in and getting behind the podcast. It spurs me on, motivates me, and inspires me to forge ahead with Guild of Dads and help as many dads as I can through the conversations that we have. You can reach out to me on Instagram and Facebook. We also have a free Guild of Dads Facebook group, which you can check out and by all means join up. We're doing quite a bit on Instagram right now, so most of the content that I'm doing is going to go on Instagram first and foremost. At Guild of Dads, my aim is to help dads sort their lives out through the podcast and the content that will expand what you think is possible for yourself, so that you can make a maximum impact on yourself and others in all areas of your life. On here, we interview fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, and also some ordinary dads just like you who are doing some extraordinary and impactful things. We'll give you actionable resources that you can take away and apply to your own life. So it pays to listen and take notes. So what do I want to do on here? I want to have conversations with men, dads and experts to transfer their practical knowledge, insight and expertise that you can apply to improve your physical health, mental health, relationships, career and the way you show up in the world as a role model to the next generation. Important conversations, because the world is changing, the role of dads and men is constantly under the spotlight, and my dream is to make Guild of Dads the go-to resource for dads like you who want to make some changes in your life. So what's this episode about today? Today I talk about fertility, and specifically male fertility. Now, we all assume that nature will work as it should do and we'll be able to get our wives or partners pregnant when the time comes. But what if that doesn't happen? Which was the case for my guest on today's show. And that's what we delve into on today's episode. Today I speak to Sean, aka Knackered Knackers, who is a dad who has gone through this experience and I'm pleased to say come out of the other end. I'm not going to delve too much into exactly what we talk about, but suffice to say Sean and his wife Jenna have been on an incredible journey of fertility. But from this journey, Sean went through some highs and low points, which spat him out the other end, a completely different man with a completely different appreciation for what is important in life. He now shares his journey with other men and couples going through the same thing, and the comedy value in his story sheds light on what is a serious issue for many couples trying to conceive across the world. It's a real privilege for me to share his story with you guys today. If you ever wonder how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. That's where you can grab a copy. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up your lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you'll be an amazing company. Like I said, it's over at guildofdads.com/dad. Dad is in capital letters. And now to my conversation with Knackered Knackers. Sean, welcome to Guild of Dads podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Likewise. It's going to be quite an interesting conversation today because it's not a topic that I've covered before on the podcast, but nonetheless, it's an important one that is necessary to discuss because it really is going to affect so many men and also women and families, and that is the subject of infertility. What I wanted to sort of start off by asking you first and foremost is kind of where your story sort of started, because I think, you know, I can't speak for every guy, but I'd imagine most guys sort of think, well, I'm going to get married and I'm going to have kids. And it's kind of like a bit of a foregone conclusion that things are going to kind of run on a smooth trajectory. But I know your experience of that wasn't the case. So when did you realize that stuff wasn't kind of going to plan, so to speak?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's exactly what I assumed as well. My wife and I, just that's it. You move along the course that we all take, like kind of get together, get the house, get married in whatever order. And then you think, right, let's have kids, like turning on like a switch. But unfortunately, in my case, we found out that wasn't so easy. So essentially, the story started, but unbeknownst to me, in 2005 when I was 22. And, you know, as a 22-year-old lad, my only concerns were where the next beer was coming from, how I was going to earn a bit of money to get that beer, etc. And I got really ill with mumps, and that therein lies the problem. I was 22. It was post-puberty mumps. It's often obviously an illness which is associated with younger people. Mm. You can catch it as an adult, and the problem was that so my kind of neck swelled up. Well, anywhere where there was glands, it swelled, so my neck went like a frog, and then it travelled south to my balls, and they were massive. They like really ballooned up, and like, to the point where there was no more room for them to expand. The skin was taut, and at the time, again, you know, just a young lad, thought it was hilarious. Well, I was ill, really ill. It was the illest I've ever been for about 3 weeks. But actually, by the time it got to my balls, like that's when I was actually starting to feel better. So I got a mate to come around, take a picture of him. I held my knob, like, and then put another fist there for scale and to show that they were bigger. And I was happily sending that photo around. It was like on the old, it was like a really old Nokia before iPhones and all that. And thought it was hilarious. But little did I know what that was doing to me, that damage. It's mumps or colitis. And that was essentially destroying the function of my balls, the testosterone making function, and more crucially, the sperm making function. So that was 2005. My only concern was where the next beer was coming from, but also had a booked holiday to Magaluf with the lads coming up, whether I was going to be well enough to go on that. And thankfully I was, went, had a great time, and then put it all behind me. Fast forward a few years, and I met my wife in 2009. We got married in 2013, and even then we'd decided that we weren't going to start trying for kids straight away. We were going to live our lives together and explore and travel and be a husband and wife. And then we made the assumption, the lazy assumption, why wouldn't you, that when we want kids we'll have them. So then moves us on to 2017 when we first started trying, and became quite apparent that it wasn't happening. So kind of 12 years later.
And it's what's interesting as well is I remember when we started trying for kids, and they say kind of, because your kind of fertility drops as you get older anyway. So I know, I think I was 30 when my first daughter was born. I remember reading somewhere that it's not unusual for it to take up to a year. So you can often be trying for like a year before you actually start to think, actually, something's not kind of quite right here. Was that your experience, where you were trying for quite a period of time before you actually thought, hang on a minute, something's a bit amiss here?
It wasn't quite a year. Because of the mumps, like, or for the years that I was just sending the photo around or just showing people it, go, hey, look what happened to my balls. People, often the odd flippant comment. And the problem is, this wasn't from any medical practitioners. It would be colleagues or friends saying, you know, that can make you infertile.
Mm.
And I'll just laugh it off and be like, nah, it's really rare. It doesn't really happen. And apparently it is very rare. But that was it. Because I'd never been told that by the doctors who I'd been to see when I had the illness. So you just carry on. But it was always, I told my wife that I'd had it. And then so as soon as we started trying in May of 17, she came off of the contraception pill. Mm-hmm. And come September, I think, well, actually it was a bit later than that, because I think they say it could take around 3 months for that to get out of the female system. So we assumed, right, okay, yeah, come September, it's going to be well out of the system by then. That's when we'll really start trying in earnest. And mm-hmm. And then so it was kind of by October, November, there was still not even a hint of pregnancy, no late periods or anything. So we went straight to the doctor then. And because of my history of having the mumps, he didn't, because I have heard a lot of people, they say that if you go to the doctor anything before a year or maybe even 18 months, they kind of say, no, this is completely normal. Keep trying, come back or whatever. Or I think it's if you go earlier than that, they say come back after a year or 18 months. But in my case, because of what I'd had, he took it, our concern, seriously and referred us both on for testing straight away.
Interesting. And so how did that kind of reveal itself in terms of, do you find out quite quick in terms of, I'm going to be careful what words I use, in terms of whether the issue is with yourself or with your wife, is it kind of quite a quick thing, or do they have to do quite a lot of investigations to affirmatively say, right, this is what we think's up here?
Well, the part of the problem is with this, the whole kind of infertility world, is that for blokes, our job is quite simple. We provide sperm. For ladies, there's a whole lot of other things, a lot of moving parts and for a long time, it's been assumed that females are the bigger contributors to infertility. But actually, it's about 50-50.
Interesting.
About 1 in 7 couples will experience infertility, and out of that, it's about 50-50 between the man and the female. But for far too long, it's been assumed to be a female-led issue. So mm-hmm. I've heard lots of accounts of people going to the doctors as a couple and only the female being sent for testing. In my case, they sent us both because I think they just... the doctor thought, well, let's check out both parties. But for the bloke, it's a more simple process. There's a few blood tests and kind of do your height, weight and BMI and stuff. But then essentially it just comes down to, can you swear on this podcast?
Yeah, you can. I just mark it as explicit, so you can bearing in mind your Instagram handle is Knackered Knackers. Yeah, you can swear. Yeah. You can swear. That's fine.
Brilliant. Yeah, it comes down to like having a wank in a cup and having your sperm analysed.
And I'm guessing that's not like it was for Steve Stifler on a Road Trip or American Pie or whatever. So it's not quite that.
Exactly. Yeah. I think I've actually quoted that in when I was talking about it in my blog. But no, absolutely not. There's no banter. You go to the clinic and like everyone's trying to avoid eye contact. You think that everyone's judging you, like the nurses or whatever, but it's not at all. They're all so professional. Like, everyone's there for the same reason. The rooms. Yeah, there's no chance of getting like a sexy nurse in for a prostate massage. It's just a really clinical, kind of actually quite
I'm
very
pleasant.
Strange room. No, yeah, exactly. The first one, I've been to various now, but the first one was I remember walking in. There was like a chaise lounge with a. You know when you go to doctors and there's like a big roll of tissue that they pull down over the bed?
Yeah.
It was like that. So it had one of those pulled down over it. And I just thought, who the fuck is going to lie on that? I won't be. My ass is going nowhere near that chaise lounge. And then there's a television with a remote control in a freezer bag. a few old magazines. I didn't even use any of this. I just went straight to my phone. Luckily, I had 4G in this one, so I was so out of sorts, and it was just a really harrowing experience. I even forgot to lock the door, which I didn't realize until the end. So it was just a really strange moment in time, and so I did that, and then I got a call probably about a week or so later.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one of the problems with, and I've discussed this with other men. We don't know whether it's because we're men, but I had the news broken to me by who I assume is like a receptionist at my doctor's.
Yeah,
just called me, and it definitely wasn't a doctor. And she just said, "Oh, the results. I think the word she used was subpar. You need to come back in 3 months and try again." And the reason for the 3 months is because sperm goes on a 90-day cycle.
Right.
It renews every 3 months. So I did that wait, and then went and did it again, same place, and then got the call after that one to say there is zero sperm zero semen in your sperm. No, not the right way. Zero sperm in your semen, which is known as azoospermia. And again, I assume it was just a receptionist phoning me because she was clearly trying to read that word, which is quite long, and if you haven't seen it before, which I hadn't even heard of it before,
mm-hmm.
She was kind of reading it phonetically, like, it says you've got azoospermia. And I was like, well, what's that? She's like, well, I don't know. And like, you know, I'm getting the news broken to me that I'm infertile on the phone by someone who's not medically trained, bless mm-hmm. her. And it's not her fault, you know, it's just her job to do it. But it was very harrowing news. And I wonder whether that's the way they break it to maybe to ladies as well, or is it because they assume you're a bloke, you can just cope with that?
Yeah.
So
I know what you mean, because it seems like a bit of a sort of, it seems a bit of like a callous way to, you know, because for men and women, it's kind of, it's so much a part of who you are, that ability to be able to father or mother children, to actually break that on it in a telephone call. I'm quite shocked by that in some respects, because they're just, I don't know, you'd think someone would sit you down in a room and just actually at least kind of do it face to face. I mean, and actually sort of say, this is what happens next, and kind of, you know, these are the options that are available to you. And do you know what I mean? It just seems a bit kind of
detached. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you'd expect that to be the case. And like, it's one of the things that kind of I say I'll be campaigning for, but what form that will take. But just the whole kind of struggling to conceive, there's so many things that need to change, I think, in that world. It's a very cold way of breaking news to people in what is essentially life-changing news, because like we discussed earlier, you make that assumption that you can just have children at the click of a finger, and suddenly when you're being told that no, that's not going to happen. And you know, at this point, it was so early days, and like you said, if I was taken in by a urologist or just anyone who had a bit more knowledge, they might say, well, there are other routes that we can take, other things we can try. Because as it happened, I ended up having two operations to try and rectify it, neither of which worked.
Mm-hmm. So did that come after you'd been diagnosed with having zero sperm count effectively? Did you then look into different options after that in terms of what you could do?
Yeah. So rough timeline is kind of October, November 2017, first approaching the doctors, early 2018, having the first sperm test. 3 months after that, towards March or April 2018, having that second one where it was confirmed. And then you just kind of go into this system. My wife and I went through the NHS of just bureaucracy and paperwork and waiting for appointments and more tests. And then I was also shown to have what's called a varicocele, mm-hmm. which is a large cluster of veins above the testicles. Mm-hmm. Whether that was caused by the mumps or I had it as well, I don't know, because people can have varicoceles anyway. Mm-hmm. We all have the veins above. It's just whether they're enlarged. And essentially what they do is overheat the balls. The balls mm-hmm. are supposed to be, I think it's around 3 to 5% cooler than the rest of the body. That's why they hang. It keeps the sperm cooler, and if essentially those veins then overheat them, overcook the sperm and damage them before they come out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that was deemed to be the first less invasive way of trying to rectify my issue. I had zero sperm. This was I was going to have an operation for that to try and reduce the size of those veins, which would then give me about a 30% chance of going from none to some. Obviously, not knowing how many, but there may be a chance that because obviously you only need one to get the job done. And so I had that operation in March 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, by this point, almost 2 years after starting to try with my wife naturally. And that was a day outpatient operation at the UCLH in London.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a horrendous operation, actually, because they're only under local anaesthetic. And they put like a tube through my neck, a vein in my neck, and went all the way down through my body. And so they, I think, first of all, inject a dye. So then they're watching via x-ray and put these metal coils all the way down to my pelvic region and then essentially like kind of coil them up, and the aim is to reduce the blood flow to those veins.
Okay.
And then hopefully reduce them in size. But being awake through the operation wasn't the most enjoyable thing. Being the University College Hospital, I had a student doctor doing the operation, being overseen by a more senior one, and you hear things that you just don't want to hear whilst you're on the operating table. Like at one point, I remember him going, "Nope, stop. If you'd done that, that would have been game over." And I'm there thinking,
it's like,
what does that mean? And there was another point where the reason they do this one with patient awake is because there are certain points where I needed to hold my breath for them to get past, like to change my physiology and to get past certain junctures inside my body.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would say, okay, we need to just take a really deep breath and hold it. And then they would say, okay, release. And that happened about three times. And then come the fourth, I'm holding my breath. I was taking the biggest gasp I can. And they didn't say to release it. And I'm there like,
going blue.
I'm not wanting to breathe out because I think, well, what am I going to do? If I breathe out, am I going to like ruin what's going on inside? So then just started to naturally kind of shake a little bit. And I had a nurse, because my head was turned to the left the whole time, so I'm going in through the right side of my neck. She kind of looked at me and went, "Are you okay?" And I was just, "Can I breathe yet? Can I breathe?" And she was like, and then the doctor said, "Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry. I forgot to tell you." So I'm like, whew. So yeah, that was a bit of a disaster. And then, so that finished, and that was a relatively quick recovery from that. I think it's about 3 days, just kind of taking it easy and then not lifting anything heavy or doing anything too strenuous for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then another sperm test 3 months after. And that was one where I didn't manage to do it. It was an absolute disaster from start to finish. I had to go back to the UCH to do this one. I hadn't done any there before, and it was a completely different environment than the first one. I got there early on my way into work, and I was the only, I think it was me and another chap in the waiting room. I thought, right, ideal. And then so I went to the room, and disaster. It was underground, so I couldn't get any Wi-Fi or 4G, and I couldn't connect to the hospital Wi-Fi. I was never going to touch those magazines or the dodgy remote in the freezer bag or anything. And also, I think the room was next to like a staff room or something, so I could just hear them all chatting. And also, I think that psychologically, I knew the importance, because I was pinning a lot of hope. But they, even though it's only 30% chance of working, I was really hoping and willing this operation to have worked. And I knew there was a lot resting on this sperm analysis that I was about to do.
Yeah.
And so I think 45 minutes later, I still hadn't managed it. Things were starting to chafe. So I just had to give up. I thought, this is just not happening. So I walked back out with my empty cup. And I remember, so I've come out, and by now the waiting room was like full up. And there was even some ladies there, I guess, in support of their other halves. And they put, none of them were probably looking at me, but I felt that everyone was staring at me.
Yeah.
So I've kind of fumbled, gone to the receptionist and handed over my empty cup and the paperwork. And she just looked at it and went, "Well, there's nothing in it."
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your tact and diplomacy on this one. Like, it's not like being a teenager and kind of surreptitiously sneaking out of the toilet upstairs. It's kind of like equivalent of like sneaking out of the toilet upstairs, straight downstairs into the lounge where your family and friends are standing there and asking you, well, did you do it? Like, kind of.
Yeah, it was horrendous. I literally like just kind of mumbled something about, oh, it just didn't work. And then I just basically threw the paperwork at her and legged it. And then after I got to work and just calmed down a bit throughout the day, I phoned back because I needed that paperwork because it was like the referral form. I couldn't just turn up to do another one. So thankfully they managed to dig it out. And I went back and I can't remember when, like maybe the next day or something, but I managed to get the job done next time. But unfortunately that operation didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so then by this point we were in the kind of IVF referral scheme and we had chosen our clinic that we were going to go to. And I'd had preliminary meetings with the urologist there and he was just waiting for the results of that operation because he said, look, if that works, then it's going to be a lot less invasive and we'd still need fertility treatment. It's very unlikely to have happened naturally, but it would be a case of me just having to spunk in a cup again and then they were to take the sperm from that. But as it didn't, they then so that's when the second operation was penciled in, which was for August 19. But this one I was actually a lot more reluctant about. It was to have my balls cut open. So what they do is obviously cut open the sac and then they take, well, sometimes only one is needed, so they take a ball out, cut it in half, open it up and try and extract sperm direct. It's called a microtese. I don't know, like the TESE, it stands for a long scientific word, which I don't know kind of off the top of my head. But so there was a lot of risks involved, kind of as with any kind of major surgery. And one of them being it can cause low testosterone, but I was told that that would be, it could be a more temporary thing. It should return. I was quite reluctant at first. I just, after the experience of the first operation with the UCH, I just didn't know if I wanted to go through more trauma and having my balls cut open. So in the end, my wife didn't push me at all. She let me kind of figure it out myself. And she just was just a bit like, look, if you didn't do it, would you regret it in the future that you didn't try everything? And I think in the end, that's what it came down to. So I was like, that is a good point. And I moved forward and just put my trust in, you know, these people who are experts in the field. So went for that one. And so we went up on the morning and it wasn't, thankfully, this time an NHS clinic. It was a private one. And so there was only me and another chap in that day and it was a very chilled environment. And they kind of gave us a pre-briefing and they said that it could take anywhere between half an hour and 2 hours, depending on how quickly they find sperm, if they find sperm. So if, for example, they were to open up the first testicle, find a load of sperm, they would harvest that and then just patch me up again. If they didn't find any in the first, they would then try the second. So obviously I'm out cold. I don't know what's going on, but my wife said that it got to the full 2 hours and I still wasn't back. So she kind of just knew that it was probably going to be negative because just the amount of time it was taking. So yeah, I came around and after the kind of got my senses back, the doctor and a nurse came and they just broke the news like there and then really. But to be fair, by this point, that we had already, our big shock moment was after the first operation when I did the sperm test three months later, because we had both really pinned a lot of hope on that. And when that one was unsuccessful, that's when we had our real like kind of moment of upset and maybe a few months of just real kind of being down. And so with this one, it was just kind of seen as, let's just try everything we can.
If it works out, it's a bonus. If not, nothing ventured, nothing gained, sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, we were fine in terms of the result, but I mean, I was anything but fine physically because he had tried both testicles. And I don't know whether he'd taken them out and juggled with them or something, but I was in a right state. It was horrendous. So because I'd read on the internet that some people say, oh, they're back to work after 5 days and stuff. For the first 5 days, I couldn't do anything except for go from bed to sofa to toilet. And that was it. It was so much pain. And it actually took the best part of 4 weeks to recover from fully.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Because the thing is a lot of people don't. It's like when you have the snip. There's quite a few people I know that have had the snip, including me. And some people are like, oh yeah, you can go back to work the first day afterwards and that. But in actual fact, I remember the doctor saying to me, because sometimes it's just tender now and again for the first year or year and a half afterwards. And I remember the doctor saying that it takes best part of a year and a half for deep healing in that area of the body to take place. So, and at the time I was doing not a load of cycling, I was doing a bit of cycling, but sometimes I'd be fine for a few months and I'd go and I'd do a ride, and for whatever reason I'd get back off the ride and whatever, and it just didn't feel right. So, you know, you take the ibuprofen and that. So I know that that area of the body is, it takes a while for it to heal. More people sort of go, well, you know, you're doing this after a few days of having a sip. And I was like, I don't think that's the case for everyone. And I think it depends on what sport you're doing as well, because, you know, if you're doing something which is, to put a finer point on it, knocking you about, I think that area has a bit of a memory, if you know what I mean. So you kind of like, if you've taken a knock in that area before and it's tender, if you take a knock in that area again, your body's like sensitive to it, if that makes any sense. These are really kind of mad discussions we're having here, but it's a sensitive area, isn't it? Once it's been had a procedure or done on it, or it's knocked about or whatever sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a sensitive area anyway, as every bloke knows. Mm. But then when you add in that surgery, which is essentially trauma, you're increasing that sensitivity, and I can feel the scarring on my bollocks. I can, if I like, have a feel around, I can feel the lumps where they've like stitched up the testicles. And, obviously, that's going to be there forever because it's scar tissue. But it's not. I wouldn't ever be going around willingly getting kicked in the nuts. That's for sure.
these bad boys have had enough. They don't want any more of this. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
So in terms of, you obviously mentioned that we've sort of touched upon the kind of physical side of things. In terms of, and you were kind of feeling quite down after this period, what sort of effect is this beginning to have on your kind of the dynamic of your relationship as well? Because we've mainly focused on you, but obviously there's two people involved with this, and your wife's probably concerned about what's going on with you. Plus, obviously, it has an effect on intimacy and stuff and that as well. The usual things that mums and dads and men and women do. What was she going through while you were going through this side of things?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a two-way street. It's just as impactful on the partner, whichever one isn't experiencing the infertility, you know, whether it's the female going through it with the bloke sat on the sidelines, if you know what I mean. But yeah, my wife, she won't mind me saying she also suffers with depression, has done for a few years. Mm-hmm. And this was just another factor, which, so I had that kind of weight on my shoulders thinking, do I really want to, it's not ideal putting her through this as well. Mm-hmm. Because she really wanted children. We both did. We just weren't in a rush to get there. As I said earlier, we wanted to be a married couple first. But then suddenly when you know it's something that you can't do, it just creates all the extra issues and stress with just as, like waiting for appointments and then having operations and which are then unsuccessful and you're back to square one. So yeah, she did struggle, but I think for the main part she shielded me and didn't really show that. And she shielded me in other ways as well, because I hadn't fully dealt with the fact that I was going through this as a bloke. I hadn't spoken to anyone. So she was telling friends and family that we were struggling to conceive, but not why.
Right.
So that was a huge protection for me. But then she's carrying the burden of that, like where people might feel that she's holding something back, which of course she was, but and people need to respect that. But yeah, whether I know that she's a talker, she would have liked to have talked from the outset. So yeah, she through protecting me, she was taking on more of a psychological burden for herself, as well as dealing with, because you deal with, yeah, one person's got the infertility, but you deal with, you're both going through infertility. So absolutely, yeah, she it wasn't a good time for her either.
Yeah, and I think as well is you've got a situation where you kind of think, this, hang on a minute, this should be a pleasurable experience, getting to this point of having children, and actually that's flipped on its head, and actually it's becoming an arduous, painful experience, both physically and mentally, that you're both having to deal with. And it's interesting because, like, when you know people that you never actually outright say to people, are you trying for kids, sort of thing, that you just kind of, people get to that age where they've got married, they've either got a cat or a dog, so the next logical thing probably, and so kind of no one ever sort of kind of asks, so to speak, but you know, usually people will say, yeah, we're trying, sort of thing, and stuff, and from my point of view, if I know someone that's kind of trying, I wouldn't ever sort of think, oh, hang on a minute, let me check my watch. They've been trying for quite a long time, haven't they, sort of thing. But yeah, it's a difficult one to kind of, especially with like grandparents and stuff as well, where they're like, oh, when am I going to be a grandma, or when am I going to be a granddad? That kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we have that. And that's another problem with it all is that the language used, because people just assume that it's going to happen. When are you going to have children? When are you going to make me a granddad or grandma or whatever? And it's like, yeah, not through lack of trying, but like, and you alluded to it earlier, but even before we knew that there was an issue, but the kind of having sex on demand does take away from it a lot. The pleasure of it, in that kind of, you know, the wife's on the ovulation sticks and tracking the cycle on apps and stuff. It's like, right, come on, this is it. This is my most fertile period. We have to go. And it's like, oh, okay. But yeah, so I know a lot of people that haven't experienced, you know, the infertility side of things, they still go through that as well, which but then once you know it's completely out of your hands, that side of it does go, because, like, you know, the ovulation sticks get put in the cupboard, that's not going to make any difference at all. So, and then you get a lot of people as well who, if you do say, oh yeah, we're struggling or whatever, I never said why, then kind of everyone has a little tale of someone they know who struggled to conceive or had IVF and then had one naturally after, or they were trying for so long but then it just happened. And it's like, by this point I'm knowing that actually it's just impossible, and you just bite your tongue, because you're not going to blurt it out in a pub with work colleagues or whoever, or even, you know, my mates, like, because I hadn't told them. And it's like, well, yeah, that's actually impossible. So
yeah,
you just kind of go, yeah, that's what we hope for.
Plus, I guess you've got the also medical appointments as well. So people are going, oh, he's going for another medical appointment. And you're like, sort of like, they're looking at a problem with my knee that I've had since I was. So you end up running out of kind of, I guess, sort of plausible things that you can keep going for tests for, sort of thing and stuff. And I think through that as well with, like, you know, if they've got a serious illness as well, you know, that they don't want to break to other people.
I kind of took the early step of eliminating that that stress by, I emailed my supervisors and just said, look, my wife and I are struggling to conceive. We're going to need to leave for a lot of appointments here and there. I will need to, and they were really supportive. And then eventually, when I started to know that I was needing operations, I just had to say that it's on my side of things. We're trying to rectify it. I didn't go into any more detail there. And then it was certified sickness anyway, but I was quite upfront in that, because it just got to the point where it's like, if I was to try and cover it up and lie about it, or just say I was going for other appointments, it just wouldn't have, they would have known, I think, or it just would have created too much stress for me on top of what's already a stressful situation.
Yeah. I guess that must have made life a lot easier, actually, being able to just sort of say, I need to go for another appointment. They're like, yeah, cool, off you go.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And then, like, I would sometimes joke, like I said earlier, I went into the UCH one day on the way to work, and I'd kind of come in and be like, oh, thanks for letting me turn up late. I've just been and had a wank in a cup. And then, like, so many other people have got a story. Like, one of my colleagues had a vasectomy, and was, like, he started telling me his story about how sore he was after and stuff. And, but yeah, I didn't say for ages that that actually it wasn't happening for me, because it's just there's a lot of shame attached to male infertility, because you go through life and you just grow up with the belief that men are men, like sport, beer, muscles, sperm. That's what we're about. That's our shtick. Like, that's what we're here for. We're the strong ones, and we provide, whether that's financially or protection or sperm. So I couldn't bring myself to tell them that was, I said that the issue was on my side, but it for a long time, even after we had made the choice, which I don't think we've come on to on the pod yet, but we made the choice to use donor sperm. And then suddenly, like, you know, my wife's becoming pregnant, and everyone's like, oh, congratulations. And someone was like, oh yeah, I thought you were a Jaffa. And it's like, well, nice. Thanks for that caring language. But like, yeah, it took a long time to actually to tell people the whole picture. And but once you have to be comfortable with yourself and deal with it yourself to be able to do that. And I was still processing a lot myself throughout. So
yeah,
it's all a process.
Yeah, because there's a picture on your social media where you're kind of sitting on the steps of the camper van and whatever. And I think you'd been away for break or whatever, and you mentioned about this point at which you kind of like you'd come to terms, you'd made peace with it and surrendered to it, and that's got to be a very difficult thing, but in some respects also a very freeing thing actually. And it's just come to me while I'm talking to you, I recently read a book called The Surrender Experiment by Michael A. Singer, and he talks about kind of surrendering to life's purpose, if that makes any sense. Not to be confused with giving up, but actually just saying, right, I can't change this. So I'm going to kind of surrender to it. And people will listen to that and think, well, that's a bit of a strange thing to say, but there's a difference between surrendering and just kind of admitting defeat, if that makes any sense. It's a very subtle difference, isn't there? Gents, I'm going to jump in here quite quickly. Now, if you're a regular listener, you may or may not know that this year I formed an exclusive brotherhood of dads called the Dad Circle. And some of the men who have joined are making some remarkable changes to their lives, their physical health, mental health, and relationships, accomplishing things that they didn't think were possible for them before joining. As a member, you get access to a proven system of self-improvement, daily accountability check-ins to keep you on track, and weekly team calls, monthly topics and challenges. Not to mention a bunch of other dads encouraging you and cheering you along the way. Now, if this sounds like something that you would benefit from and you want to check it out, then you can do so over at www.thedadcircle.com/join. That's thedadcircle.com/join. If you're driving right now or doing something, do a pause, rewind a few seconds, and jot the link down, then go and check it out. If that wasn't enough, right now you can try it out for £1. That's just £1 for your first 7 days. I can't say fairer than that. £1 could be the best investment you ever make, so try it out today.
Absolutely, you own it. Because any event is an event. It's us, people, that attach emotions to it, whether that's like a positive or a negative. It's just an event, and obviously this was a life-changing event. But and once I had gone through essentially what is a grieving process, because something did die, my genetics, my ability to be able to pass on my DNA, my genetics died. So what I didn't know at the time was I was grieving. I went through the stages of kind of anger, denial, blame. I remember phoning my mum, and because the only people that knew throughout from the outset was my mum and my wife's mum, so we could kind of just talk to someone. I remember phoning her saying, oh, did I not have the mum's jab? Because what I know now is that I was clearly looking to attach a bit of blame, which and I did have it. And so I'm glad that I did. And I'm glad that I never kind of was able to place that blame on anyone. But as it happens, I haven't fully read up on it. I don't care, because it's not going to change it. But I think there was a big problem with people in my age group who were vaccinated in the kind of early 80s, where it didn't really work. And a lot of people who then went to kind of uni or big places where it can spread got it because the strain of vaccine wasn't quite good enough or something. I don't know. But as I said, I haven't really read up on it. So it doesn't, for me, I don't need to know it. It's happened. I've accepted it. So yeah, I went through those. A lot of those were kind of subconsciously moving through the cycles. I was angry for a long time and I didn't know why. I just felt, well, obviously I knew why, but I was just angry at the world. And then I started moving through it. But with acceptance, I found it was more of an active phase. I had to work towards that. It didn't just come, but it came by way of, I was kind of self-therapizing throughout the journey. When I mentioned earlier that when I had 5 days where I just had the operation on my balls and I couldn't move, all I could do was think. And that was, it was a good place to be, actually. It was hard. It wasn't easy, but I essentially, because I'd had my identity as a man stripped away, like my perception of like what I could provide, suddenly I couldn't. So I was having to strip back myself, like an onion almost, like stripping back the layers and unlearning everything that I thought I was, and then really looking at who I was, which and realizing that actually, no, you're still a good man. You're strong, you're brave, you're compassionate, empathetic, humorous. And realizing all the good traits I've got and then kind of reapplying those layers and building that as an armor. And that was like way back after the operation. But then also I took stock of a lot of things in my life, what I was happy with, what I wasn't, realized I wasn't happy at work. And so I made a few moves. And I also spoke to a friend who just done started up a business, and he kind of pointed me in the direction of a lot of like businessmen and personal development books and podcasts. And that is essentially, it's changed my life. Changed who I am, whereas like I usually just listen to music back, and now I'm just podcasts all the time, just learning, growing, and just doing that work on myself. Mm-hmm. People,
what age were you off with? What age were you at when that happened? Just out of interest, Sean.
So this was 2019. So would have been 36.
It's really interesting. It's really interesting. And people that regularly listen to this podcast will know why I'm kind of sort of chuckling a little bit, not in a rude kind of way. So one thing that I've kind of encountered, like my old man passed away at 36, and so that was the kind of sort of turning point for me. And a previous podcast guest of mine, Peter Ludwig, said that there's 2 days in your life when you're born. One is the day you're physically born, and the second is the day you start taking 100% responsibility for your life. And interestingly, through all the guys I interview on this podcast, a lot of them have kind of something between sort of 36 and 45, like a life-changing event, which is kind of just, it's a leveler. It's either someone getting sick or losing a relative, or you know, divorce or separation. Something happens. There's like an event that happens, which makes you kind of look in. You kind of suddenly think, well, hang on a minute, what do I want to do? Who do I want to be? What is important to me? And all of a sudden you kind of go on this kind of inner journey. I loosely call it confronting the man in the mirror effectively. Up until that point, you kind of look at the man in the mirror and you kind of run away from them because it means confronting some quite difficult things. But I think there's a point at which over either the passage of time or an event, you can't keep running anymore. You've got to turn and face it down. And for a lot of guys, I think like our parents' generation, it would have been probably dismissed as a midlife crisis, you know, would have had an affair or bought a red sports car or, you know, something like that. I think our generation, maybe you're actually beginning to kind of see it for what it is, as an opportunity rather than a kind of a negative, if that makes any sense. So it's just, that's why I asked you what age you were, and it kind of sort of, and I paused when you said 36, because I was like, interesting. I always look for patterns emerging, and it's a thing that I'm seeing more and more frequently, and it's usually around about 36, late 30s. So
that's really interesting. It's and I think you have to be willing to do that work, like you said, to look at the man in the mirror. I think David Goggins calls it the accountability mirror. And it's hard. It's really hard to look inside yourself and really take a good look at who you are. Because, and like you said, I think in the past that would have been dressed up as a midlife crisis. But actually, it's people realizing that they've been chasing the wrong things for so many years, because we automatically get fed to us through society, etc., that you should be chasing cash and cars and houses or whatever else. And people go, actually, well, that's really not fulfilling. And I realized that myself, but it came through another way, which I never would have asked for. But I am grateful for what's happened to me, because it's now made me into a better person. And I will only keep working on myself every day. I think the Japanese have a word for it. It's Kaizen, I think it is, like kind of continuous improvement. And that's what I thrive on and chase now. And it's what really awakening to try and better yourself every day. And I always say to my wife, I want to be the best husband and the best father that I can be. And we have good communication. And if there's something I'm not doing quite right, or that she would prefer I do, then I'll do it. And that's, so it's not just about improving myself. It's about improving who I am to others as well. So that's why acceptance is a more active phase. I started on a Tony Robbins book, which was quite heavy going. But then I went on holiday and read Henry Fraser's book, who went through a life-changing accident when he was one of the, I think it was like 17, got paralyzed from the neck down. And his book was about power of acceptance and gratitude. And that essentially, I started writing that. So that was when I was still my ball. So I still had a big scab on them. Sorry to be quite
it's all right.
graphic, but we were in the south of France. We took the camper down, and annoyingly for myself, I couldn't go in the sea because I still hadn't healed. So I was just kind of chilling on the beach reading that book. And that night when we got back to our little campsite, I started writing on the notes on my phone my story. And that was inspired by Henry Fraser passing on his. So I was still along with this. So that was September 19. I didn't go live with my Instagram account until January this year, 21. And it took a long time to reach going live, but that's where it started. And it was very powerful to get out everything that I'd been feeling onto essentially paper. And so it was the start of a new me, essentially, and a better me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing is as well is, up until that point, you're scared that people are going to kind of judge you, or they're going to think, you know, you're going to get, I don't know, you're going to get people ridiculing you or whatever. Because the thing is again, to your point about, you know, how we're brought up, you know, we're kind of brought up that, you know, people are going to ridicule you, take the piss out of you and mock you and all the rest of it and stuff. Even though it's a kind of important subject that you're, Instagram account is about, at the back of your mind you still get that, where you're like, no one's going to listen to what I've got to say, and so you get all these self-defeating thoughts, and then there comes a point at which you're like, I've got to pull the trigger on this and just do it. And then all of a sudden you're like, I just don't know what I made so much fuss about, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It was that went on for a long time. It was fear and procrastination, and I've seen James Clear talk about it a few times, about procrastination, and which essentially is another form of fear, because it wasn't until May 20 last year where I first told anyone other than my our mums. I've been contacted via our fertility clinic to see if we want to be interviewed by the BBC. So essentially we were all due to restart. So once we had made the decision to have donor sperm, then the kind of baton passes to my wife, and she has to do all the injections and stuff they downregulate her natural monthly cycle, take control of it, and then she then produces eggs, like more eggs than what you would have naturally. And it's a very hard going physically thing on her. We're all due to start and have so we had her egg retrieval, and then she got really, really ill. So that was yet another delay. She developed something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. Mm-hmm. Very poorly from that. So we should have had eggs put in, the eggs made matched with the sperm through the ICSI treatment in December, and then put back in hopefully as embryos mid-December last year. She got ill. There was yet another delay. We had to wait a few months for her body to recover. We were then due to start again. I think it was March last year, and then the pandemic came. and everything, all fertility treatment was put on hold. So when that was when that restarted, that's why our clinic contacted us to see if we would be interviewed about the restart and how the pandemic affected us and like in terms of fertility treatment. So when we were waiting for the BBC guys to come around that day, I was painting, classic lockdown one, doing a bit of DIY. And I was listening to a podcast, another story of someone who'd kind of overcome adversity. And it was another accident. It was someone called Ben Tansley. He had a motorcycle accident and became paralyzed. And his story, just like how he had really just accepted what happened to him. And it was just so empowering that when the chaps came and interviewed us, I just spilt my story on camera. And as it happens, it wasn't really the what they were there for. So it didn't even ever make it off the cutting room floor. But that was good for me because I got it out. I remember cathartic, before they came, yeah. I said to my wife, I said, I'm going to talk about my infertility. And she was just like, are you sure? Because I hadn't told anyone. I'm about to talk about it on camera. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. So that evening, because we didn't know if it was going to go out or not. So I spent the rest of the evening phoning close family and friends that we hadn't told. And that was May 20. And as I said, I still didn't even start the account until January 21 because it's actually one thing then telling your close friends and family, but a whole other thing going, putting yourself out there to others. But
yeah.
I just kind of realized that I thought, well, I have come to terms with this. Why not use my story to help someone else? And that was always my aim, just someone else. If I just helped one person, then I've succeeded. And thankfully it's gone a bit further than that one, which is really good to know.
Yeah, well, you've got a lot of people kind of picking up on you. Your message is resonating with a lot of people, I can see, by the amount of people that are kind of interacting with what you're doing. And I think the thing is what's interesting is there's a, you know, it's a really, you almost got me crying this morning when I saw the video of your wife going through the injections and stuff and that, because what it's not kind of clear from this is that obviously you went through the mill medically to begin with, and then at a point that baton passes across to your wife, and having to do the fertility injections in directly into her stomach, that's pretty hardcore, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's taking control of her hormones, like they are suppressing them, and that for any lady is just so hard, and so physically it's really challenging. But then also you've got all the hormones and emotions just swirling, and it's not an easy time. And then obviously there's so much almost pressure attached to it as well because of the desperation to have children. It's a really hard time, and kind of I felt that having had the operations myself, I felt more invested. If, for example, I hadn't had any issues and she was just having to go through this, I would have been on the sidelines and not really knowing what to do. But I think that kind of it allowed me to be more empathetic towards medical procedures and stuff, because I've never had anything before prior to that, no injuries, no broken bones, etc. So suddenly I'd had those, the big traumatic ones, and so I was then able to, when she was really ill after the operation to remove her eggs, just kind of knew how it felt to be on the sofa and really poorly.
Do you think it brought you closer together? Because you're almost kind of like in the trenches together now, because one of you's gone through it and then the other one's going through it, and it kind of like becomes almost like it's kind of sealed with blood, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, 100% it has. And I mean, we're both, she says that how just more open I am now, like when we go for walks and we have just the nice conversations, and because it opened my mind more, so it's changed me as well. And I think it's changed me into a deeper person. But yeah, as a couple as well, just a lot closer, like you said, because you're in the trenches, it's blood in, blood out. We are a lot stronger, which is really good. But as I said, you know, there's so many positives to take from it.
Yeah. And it becomes meaningful. My big thing is kind of, I was heavily influenced by Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And I think it's these things in our life that give us meaning, and that I think kind of where the richness of life really lives, to be honest. And it sounds kind of like you say when you're kind of younger, it's about sort of, you know, external things. But I think as you get older, it becomes more kind of internal and a bit kind of like the simple things kind of make you more appreciative. And they can be really small things, like a smile or a kind of, you know, a walk in the forest or whatever and stuff. And like, even the clouds parting and feeling the heat on you, the sun on your face and stuff and that. And you kind of realize that you're, I think when you get into second half of life, your mortality becomes a bit more apparent. So you're like, hang on a minute, there's going to be one day, and this is going to sound really kind of, morbid, but I don't want it to. You realize that one day it could be the last time you feel the warmth on your face. Mm. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so you don't kind of take it. Whereas I think when you're in your 18 or 20, you're just like, yeah, whatever. Right. Next thing. And you're jumping onto the next thing that's kind of going to take you along in the thing. Whereas you kind of, yeah, your outlook changes a little bit, particularly when kids kind of arrive as well. Cause like for me, I sometimes think, hang on a minute, that little person could possibly be the last person that I see before I leave this world, probably at my bedside, or maybe not. I don't know how I'm going to go, but you become more attuned to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I completely agree. And gratitude was something that really helped me throughout the process as well. I think it was a book by Vex King I read. He talks about extreme gratitude, because we can all be grateful for, I don't know, like having a car, my camper van, for example. I love it, but it's a thing. I could lose that thing at any moment. But actually, when you really find the joy in life, and like you said, the sun on your face, the fresh breeze, one thing that I remember thinking was, so after hearing Ben Tansley's story, who was paralyzed from the waist down, I think it is, but I went on a walk and I don't know what plant it was, but there were plants like kind of almost stinging my legs. I was walking through wearing shorts. It wasn't stinging nettles, but it's like they're just quite sharp. And I remember thinking, but I'm grateful that I can feel that, because Ben can, and there's many other people can't feel that or wouldn't be able to do this walk. And being grateful for those small things, you really start opening up. I think that gratitude has been proven to open up new neural pathways in your mind.
Yeah,
and just all leads into positivity, which again is something that a positive person is more open-minded, and whereas a pessimist, if a problem occurs, that kind of, if you've got a lot of pessimism, negativity, stress, you are more narrow-minded and less likely to problem solve your way out of something. And it's all entwined, like gratitude and positivity and with happiness. I started during the first lockdown, because I had more time working from home, I started a daily routine after reading The Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod, I think it is. And started doing yoga in the mornings and reading a page of a book called The Daily Stoic, Brian Holiday. And then I downloaded an app called Day One, which is, you can just do three things that you're grateful for that day, three things you want to do, and some affirmations as well. And then I'd do 5-minute PM as well, and like, what went well today? What could go better? What could go better would usually be eating chocolate, or less chocolate in my case. And it's actually really nice, because I've been looking back at those recently. So one's from this time last year, and it's really nice to see what made you happy that day when you're reflecting in the evening.
Yeah.
Then you get a secondary hit of it, because you think, like, a few times I've said, oh, I've had a nice phone chat with one of my mates today. Like, what a good bloke he is, and how lucky I am to have him in my life.
Yeah.
And then that reminds me of that person. And as I said, you get like a second hit of that happiness and that gratitude to have such close friends in my life.
Yeah, it gives you a reminder to give them a call and stuff as well. There's one that I don't think my bag's close by. There's one I use, which is called the 6-minute journal, which is basically 3 minutes in the morning. So you do three things that you're grateful for. Then it's what you achieved today. And then I think there's an affirmation. And then again, in the evening, there's kind of what went well today. And so it's kind of literally in 6 minutes. And there's kind of, the good thing about it is that there's Stoic quotes all the way through, and there's the different philosophy quotes all the way through. And it's, but that's quite good. If you use that with, like you say, the Daily Stoic, It just kind of brings you kind of down. It just kind of grounds you a little bit, so to speak. See, there must have been a point. There must have been a point where you eventually get the kind of that you. What can you remember the day when you actually got the news that you that your wife was expecting?
You won't believe this. It was today last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm privileged. I'm privileged then speaking to you today on the anniversary then.
Yeah, it was my wife said to me a minute ago, you know what day it is? Luckily, I was able to, you know, a lot of blokes might get that question. You think, oh, is it my anniversary? Is it this? Is it that? But I knew what day it was. So, yes, it was today. Yeah, I woke up. I don't think either of us slept very much that evening because we had the embryos. We went for two put back in on the 25th of June last year. And then the clinic give you the date to do the pregnancy test.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in this world, like from accounts I follow on Insta, there are a lot of people that do it early, but you need to be really careful with that because one of the last injections that the lady takes is what's called a trigger shot, which I don't know exactly what it does, but it's something about the hormones, just like a final boost before you have the embryos put back mm-hmm. in. I believe that there are certain chemicals in that trigger shot that can also provide false positives for pregnancy tests.
Okay, yeah.
So people I know have had the heartbreak where they've done it a little bit early, like kind of after 9 days or whatever, or a week, and then it's shown a faint positive line and then got to the point where they're supposed to do it. And unfortunately it's been negative. So we stayed well clear of that. We were like, no, we're just going to do it on the day we're told. And we just had 2 weeks. It was the 2 week wait, as they call it, in the fertility world. And we just walked a lot, just spent a lot of time being together. And yeah, then, and I'd done a lot of visualizations in part of my morning routine, which would back up my affirmation of the fact that we were pregnant. And my wife was doing a lot of guided meditations about imagining those embryos implanting. And I think with two people, like, I know a lot of people may dismiss this, but I feel that with both of us putting out those vibes of just being so sure that it worked. And I had visualized doing that, the pregnancy test. It was slightly different. I didn't know. I just assumed the ladies peed on it. But I think you probably can, but she went in a cup and then put it in. I think it's probably a little bit less messy or something. I don't know. But so it was a little bit different. That's just from kind of being a bloke and not knowing the full ins and outs.
My wife scared the shit out of me last year because she left a digital thermometer on the side. And to my naked eye, I walked into the bathroom and I was like, and it's a biological impossibility for me to have kids now. So, I walked in and for a minute, my heart skipped a beat and I was like, what?
Okay.
And then I realized it was a digital thermometer and not a pregnancy test kit. And I think I WhatsApped her and I said, don't ever do that to me again.
Brilliant. So it was an amazing moment, as I'm sure you've experienced with yours. It's just kind of being there and sending around the picture to everyone and just, like just tears of joy for a change, which is a welcome relief from all the angst that we had along the way.
Yeah, excellent. You go through the nine months and you're kind of sort of thinking, I hope everything's going to be okay. And what day did they arrive in this world in the end?
So we had twins, a boy and a girl, Ray and Evelyn, on the 16th of February this year.
Excellent.
And I must admit, I was so glad like to get the pregnancy out of the way. I was shitting myself for the whole 9 months plus. And we had a few late night trips up to the hospital because of reduced movement. I was constantly just worried the whole time and trying to be positive. That's what I'm all about. And again, I would still continue my morning routine. And I'm not taking anything away from people that manage to conceive naturally at all. So I know it's just as like kind of worrying, but weird because it was, I think, virtually four years in the making to get to this point. I remember the post-skip changing as well about the safe point or something. So I remember, obviously everyone knows the 12-week scan. It's like what I always thought was the safe one. So you get to that, had that, I think, right, phew, big sigh of relief. And then someone mentioned, something about the 20-week scan being a big one. And I'm like, oh my God, so it's like another 8 weeks of just get there, just get there. And then I remember my wife said, so we got to about 21 weeks. I'm like pretty chilled now. And I'm thinking, right, bumps come in. And then my wife was like, yeah, but it's 24 weeks where they are viable. And if we were to have them before now, and I know this is, I don't know much about it, but I know it's actually outrageous because I think by even 20 weeks, they are like, you know, a little person. Mm. But I don't want to get too much down that because I know there's a lot of people very passionate about that. And I don't know enough to talk about it. But so my wife then's put this 24 week kind of marker. And I'm like, oh, no, so now get to 24 weeks. We get there. And I'm like, whew, breathe again. And then I text someone at work and was like, yeah, but well, I think it's from a previous role. And texted me and said, oh, how are you getting on? I was like, yeah, it's great. It's 24 and a half weeks. And he was like, oh, that's really good. You must be really relieved. Only a week and a half to go until 26 weeks. And I'm thinking, well, what's this 26 weeks? So the ballpark, it just kept moving back. But so, yeah, I must admit, it was just a worrying time. But the moment that we, and then true to form, pregnancy wasn't easy either. Sorry, the birth wasn't easy either.
With two as well, that's going to be uncomfortable in the later stages for sure.
Yeah. Oh, she was like an upturned sheep. Like she was lying down on the sofa. That was it. She was stuck until I could come and help her up. But she was really big, but she grew very good, very healthy baby. So Ray was 7 pounds 1 and Evelyn was 6'11". So yeah. So very good, healthy babies. And, but yeah, as I said, like she had 2 blood transfusions during the C-section. But then the moment of just holding both of the babies, just a lot, everything changed. And to anyone, I know there's a lot of people, blokes who have no sperm. There's a lot they have to go through about do they want to use donor sperm? Will they be able to bond with the babies? All I ever say is just what I've said a few times is I defy anyone who has natural children to say they love theirs more than I love mine, because it's overwhelming. Like that feeling of just every day, just like any moment I'm away from them, if I'm at work, all I want to be is at home. And it really is an amazing feeling.
I love it. And it's the eyes. Someone said to me recently, they were like, what do you remember about like becoming a dad? And I was like, it's the eyes. It's their eyes looking up at you. That's the kind of, it's like, it's kind of like, and when they sort of come out, you're kind of like, there's a split second where you're kind of shocked that there's a baby coming out. And people are like, what do you mean about that? And I was like, I don't know whether in my mind's eye, I thought that it was going to be like, I don't know, a monkey or a sheep or something. I don't know. But it's just like, for a split second, you're like in shock. Like, it's like,
and then you've got these eyes looking. 100% dependent on you as well, and you think, oh my, I have to really up my game now, and it's not about me anymore. And it's brilliant, like you said, like the eyes when you walk in a room and they see you and then they light up and they smile for that recognition, that love. Like, it's just, that's enough. No one can ever take that moment away from you. Like, you just, we really try to slow down and not like put too much like thought into the future about, oh yeah, when they do this, when they do that, just take every moment for and enjoy it, because everyone says they grow up so fast and we're already seeing it. You know, they're only 4.5 months old. So.
Yeah. Mine are 8 and 11 now. So I get answering back and I get sassiness and all this kind of stuff. And like doing these like sort of funny faces and stuff. And I'm like, brilliant. What? I was like, just like, you know, so there's a fine line between cheekiness and kind of sassiness and kind of crossing that line sort of thing. But my old man used to say to me that girls kind of, they practice with dads basically. So in the sense that the kind of looks that they're going to give and the buttons they're going to push and whatever, dad's the one that gets kind of practiced on, and then they move on to their boyfriends when they get older sort of thing.
Evelyn already knows what she's sassy already, even at her age. She knows what she wants when she wants it. And we're like, oh, this, she's going to be headstrong.
Yeah. It's going to be the 2 o'clock in the morning. Dad, I've run out of money. I need to get a taxi. Can you come and pick me up? It's going to be maybe one of those sort of things. It's such a good feeling. And what I kind of like about the other thing as well is I've interviewed guys around paternal mental health. And I think that one of the kind of, there's a kind of perfect storm, you know, we've talked about this kind of midlife sort of thing that happens about 36 and stuff. I've spoken to a few paternal mental health people about this, and I've said, look, I'm wondering whether or not this kind of men's mental health not being that great in the few years after having kids, if it coincides with this midlife point, it's kind of becomes like a bit of a perfect storm. And I've not been able to kind of actually prove my point, but it just anecdotally, just from the people I've spoken to about this midpoint life, and then the people I've spoken to the mental health side of things, paternal mental health, I think there is a perfect storm when these two things collide. Yeah. And like I say, I can't prove it because I've not got a laboratory experiment where I can, you know, where I can do a peer review on however many expectant fathers and, you know, ask them whether there's life events happening at the same time as I have kids sort of thing. But yeah, I think there is definitely, but I think what's good about you is that you've done quite a lot of inner work beforehand. So even though you've got this birth trauma, I think probably you've been doing the work before it actually has happened, if that makes any sense. So,
yeah, absolutely. I know that I'm a better person for it, and by knock-on effect, will be a better father as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing story, and it's just incredible, like how sort of far you've come with it. And it's just fascinating speaking to someone to get a kind of first-hand account as to you know what you experienced and what your wife experienced and the kind of ups and downs and whatever. And you know, you've got a ton of people that are beginning to kind of cotton onto your message and what you're talking about. So it's and doing group meets and stuff and that as well. So
thank you. Yeah, I've just put out a date for a second one actually. I just kind of the more it's talked about, the more it's normalized, and there won't be so much shame and stigma attached to it. And I met a chap recently who happened, it's a bit of an odd one. Like, he contacted me on my Instagram. We had a mutual friend. And then, so I kind of said, well, if you know them, like, surely you must live to like near to London or around it. And he said where he lived, and it's the same town as me. So what's the chances? So we met for a beer, and it was just really powerful. It was the first person I'd ever spoke to in person who had experienced the same. And then, so I just got the idea for now. I was like, well, why don't put out something just to see if anyone else wants to meet up. And I didn't. Yeah. So I held the first one in May. Didn't know if anyone else was going to turn up, and five other chaps did. And yeah, I've just set a date for a second one in July. But so the guys that came on the first one, we then started a WhatsApp group, and I added in a couple of other people who, as long as the others who had met in person were happy to have others they hadn't met come in. And we all just talk and support each other. And if anyone has questions, that they ask. And I've always said, I'm no expert. Absolutely not. I'm just putting out my experience in the hope that it helps others. And also, like I said, it normalizing the conversation around male infertility. And there are things that some of them ask, and I don't know, have anything about, because there's lots of different types and everyone has slightly different experiences. And other people are answering it or helping and just pointing in the direction. And it's really empowering. And it's just good to know that the chaps that aren't suffering this silence alone anymore.
Yeah. And I think the thing is as well, is there is, from people I've spoken to, you know, if you can have that kind of brotherhood and that kind of that tribe and group of guys, it's a lot better. And I think men are returning to their tribes a lot more now. That's what I'm doing with Guild of Dads. And that's what a lot of other guys are doing in terms of kind of bringing people back together and talking about different stuff that they're going through. But also you've got the other thing that is kind of, I don't know if it's a curse of the modern world. We know that testosterone levels are dropping in men, and they have been dropping for the last, you know, since I think the testosterone levels of a guy in probably 1940s was a lot higher than what it is now. But also I spoke to a guy called John Gray, who's the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And he said that women's estrogen levels are also dropping as well. So fertility has been affected by the modern world across the board. It's
absolutely,
although we're talking about in terms of men today, it's, you know, it's and also our generation are generally having kids later as well. Whereas I think a lot of people would have had kids in their 20s. Now people are having the kids in their 30s or even 40s. And so, so again, it's going to be something that's going to come up more and more frequently now, I would say. So
absolutely, yeah. There's a few programs. I think there's one on Netflix about kind of like the, all the disruptors in the environment now that affect hormones, whether it's, like you said, testosterone or estrogen. Like you said, like our grandparents wouldn't have experienced. They had what we now call organic food in the supermarket is just what they had. That was just the food because there wasn't as many pesticides on sprayed on them. Plastics can have an effect on hormones, like so water bottles, etc., telephones, technology in general. There's a lot of disruptors out there that are a part of our everyday life now that are attacking us, attacking our hormones and our functions that we just don't know, blissfully unaware about, and diet, lifestyle as well for blokes, like alcohol, lack of exercise, general diet, smoking. It's all things that impact testosterone. And for me, going back to that operation where I had my balls cut open, that decimated mine. So I now have to have replacement testosterone replacement, and I will do for the rest of my life. But I get no regrets. I still, I'm glad I went for the operation, and it is what it is. I was probably likely to have to go on to it at some point anyway. Because of the damage that the mumps did to my testosterone making function, which all starts in the brain. The early tests I had, the blood tests, were showing that my FSH levels and LH, which one's for testosterone, one's for sperm production, they were both super high, like ridiculously, like over the normal range. And that's because my brain knew that something wasn't right and was sending functions to like heightened signals to get that, kickstart the testosterone and sperm production, and it wasn't responding. So I was like, kind of before the operation, I was just above the lower end of normal for testosterone, but now I just flatlined after the op. So
yeah,
but it is what it is. It's, and again, it's just another message that I can get out there about if you can change your lifestyle and help these things.
A lot of men aren't getting a great deal of sleep. And one of the things that I get guys on my brother's dad circle to do is sort their sleep out, is to go to bed earlier and get up earlier. Because I think many guys are going to bed at like 1-2 o'clock in the morning on Netflix binges or an Xbox or whatever. And that's just, but also what's interesting, I interviewed an evolutionary biologist called Anna Machin, and she suggested to me that they've done studies on this. Actually, your testosterone drops after you have kids, after your wife has children. And the reason being is that it's your evolutionary, it's nature's way of basically getting you to stick around. So basically evolutionary, we would be out looking for another mate. But it's an evolutionary quirk of human beings, male human beings, is that our testosterone level drops so that we're going to stick around and we're going to do, you know, building the nest and looking after the kids and stuff. So not only do you have the kind of drop that happens over age, but there's also a distinct drop that happens after you have kids as well. So people don't realize that. So
yeah, that's really interesting. Like, you think, wow, how is, I think the evolution is wonderful, like kind of, and things that we just don't know how they happen. And like, for example, like webbed feet and toes, like we're just like, don't need those anymore. And they just get evolved out, or a tail. Don't need it. Like, how do you pass that message on to the next generation that we don't need it? And they just don't grow it. Like, it's really interesting.
It's crazy. Listen, it's been a fascinating conversation with you today. And I'm really, the work that you're doing is really good, and thanks so much for sharing your story with me, because I think hopefully it will resonate with a lot of guys. And when I put this podcast out, I'll make sure that we use a title so that it is going to get found. What is the best way for people to find out about what you're doing and link up with you or ping you a message, Sean?
At the moment, I'm just on Instagram. I better check my handle actually before I say it, commit to it. I'm not sure if there's an underscore in there.
There is it. Yeah, it's knackered, there is, underscore knackers, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I should really have known that. So it's knackered knackers with an underscore between the two. But I'm possibly going to look to building a website at some point in the future when I've got a bit more time and energy after the babies.
Yeah,
don't keep me up all night, which I'm grateful to get there. But I will be looking to expand what I do at some point. But at the moment it's the Instagram. It's kind of my story, and I've got a rough, I followed a rough timeline at first. It's about just telling my story, but then every now and again, something will come up and I think I'm going to write about that. So yeah, it's just, it's evolving, growing into its own thing, really.
Excellent. I love it. And one question I'm going to ask you, which I don't prime anyone that comes on the podcast for. And the question is this, what is it in life that gives you meaning, Sean?
Oh, that is a good question. I would say for me, that is, it's my wife and babies, 100%. Just everything. They are my world. So I revolve around them. They're my center, my gravitational pull. Mm-hmm. Even before I had the babies, like when it was just my wife and I always begrudged being late off of work or having to work away. All I wanted to do is be with her. We always laugh and just being close. And you don't have to be, like, even if you're not talking, but you're just together, it's just precious. And now, since I've had the babies, that is just, the desire to be with them is just, it's increased so, like, inexplicably. I can't even explain that desire that I have to just want to be at home with them.
Yeah.
So we discussed earlier, you said about kind of mortality. And I guess that comes down to a little bit of that. You said, what in life gives you meanings? Well, actually, it's, if you look at afterlife, what lives on, it's not people talking about what stuff you had. It's about who you are and what you did. And that's what lives on. And I want people to, I don't want to get too morbid about it, but I want to be remembered as a good man, but mostly a good husband and a good father.
Mm.
Yeah. People won't remember what car I had at whatever age or whatever.
No. So
it's about, just giving it the best shot you can and not having any regrets.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And I kind of guessed before you said that was going to be, because of everything you've gone through, I kind of guessed that was probably what you were going to say. So I'm glad it did do. So thank you very much for speaking to me today. I'm gonna wish you on your merry way, but all the best of luck with what you're doing, and I hope it grows and continues to kind of resonate with a number of different guys going through the same thing.
Excellent, Joe. Thanks very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
No worries. Take care, man. A big thanks to Sean for joining me. If you want to check him out, the best place to do so is Instagram. His handle is knackered_knackers. Check him out, ping him a DM if his story resonates. And most importantly, share with anyone you know who has been through or is going through the fertility journey. You can also link up with me over on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook using the handle at Guild of Dads. So reach out, let me know what you got out of today's episode and what in particular resonated with you about what we spoke about. Sean's journey and the journey him and his wife have been on is a pretty amazing journey. But what I think resonated for me most out of our conversation and the main takeaway I took was that increasingly through the conversations I have on here, I'm reaching a conclusion that men go through this kind of crossroads around about the midway point of life, just shortly after having children. And Sean's experience kind of bears this out. That he went through this kind of transitional phase, which kind of collided with his fertility journey, and he's come out the other end as a completely different man from what he was when he went into it. And I think that's quite a powerful thing to take away from the episode, and something which I think that we can all reflect on, how life shapes us and changes us, and how this kind of midpoint life after having children can really make a massive impact on how we see our lives going forward. I'm teaching you how to follow a simple system and plan, just like many of my guests, in order to transform all areas of your life so that you can live more purposefully with much greater fulfillment and meaning, at the same time as becoming the man and dad you always wanted to be. It's all in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint. You can grab it free over at guildofdads.com/dad. In capital letters, Dad. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves, inspire others. The fee for this show is that you share it with others so that they may benefit from anything you find useful or interesting. And gents, this is as easy as hitting the share button, putting in the names of 5 other men, WhatsApping them, texting them, sending them a messenger and saying, hey, check this podcast out. If you know someone that's into podcasts, has a smartphone and could do with improving their relationship, mental health, physical health, and the way they show up in the world, share this episode with them. If you can, leave me a review and a rating in your favorite podcast player of choice, be it whether that's Spotify or iTunes. It really helps to grow the show numbers and get the show found by lots of other men. So I want to thank you guys for getting behind what I'm doing. I want to continue to grow this. I've already mentioned the Facebook group, the growing people listening and tuning in to the fascinating discussions over here. So go ahead, join the guild today. Hopefully you find something insightful in every episode. So share with dad you know. In the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.